from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, the tragic news of Oscar-winning actor Philip Seymour Hoffman's death by apparent heroin overdose after more than two decades of sobriety calls attention to the immense challenges faced by those dealing with addiction. We discuss drug addiction, relapse, and the most effective methods of treatment, rehabilitation, and prevention. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. The recent death of Oscar winner Seymour Philip Hoffman, one of the finest stage and film actors of our time, has once more put the spotlight on drug addiction and the global epidemic of heroin. Deaths by drug overdose have been rising steadily over the past two decades, and according to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, 105 people die each day in the United States as a result of drug overdoses, and another nearly 7,000 are treated in emergency departments for the misuse or abuse of drugs. Prescription opioid abuse costs upward of an estimated $56 billion in total workplace, health care, and criminal justice costs. And in this morning's opening forum hour, we want to turn our attention once again to drug addiction and what can be done about its staggering and lethal toll on lives. With us in studio is Keith Humphreys. He's professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford School of Medicine and focuses there on the prevention and treatment of addictive disorders. He's also a research scientist at the VA Medical Center in Palo Alto and former senior policy advisor at the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy. Keith Humphreys, good to have you.
Good to see you again, Michael.
Good to see you. Also good to see Vitkus Eisen, who's here with us in studio, CEO of HealthRight 360, Bay Area-based group of health programs, including Walden House and Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic. Welcome to the program.
Good to see you.
And we also have David Sheff back with us on Forum, journalist and author of a new book, Clean, relatively new, subtitled Overcoming Addiction and Ending America's Greatest Tragedy. His earlier books include Beautiful Boy, which was a memoir about a father's journey through his son's addiction. Welcome back, David Sheff.
Thank you, Michael.
And let me begin, if I may, Keith Humphreys, with you. I don't want to necessarily focus on the case of Philip Seymour Hoffman, but he had been drug-free for about 20 years and was a major talent and certainly had, you know, in addition to his gifts as an actor, everything that many people think one could hope for in life, three kids and a relationship that had gone south. But relapses, I mean, they happen all the time, and they happen even after that many years have gone by. And I think the realization is almost anything can trigger them, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, addiction is like other chronic disorders that are not curable. I mean, they can be managed, but we can't eliminate them, just like diabetes or low back pain or high blood pressure. You can go through treatment periods and recover your function, but that doesn't mean that it can't come back. And people are particularly prone to relapse in times of stress, in times of deprivation, sometimes also at very good times. People haven't learned how to celebrate and be happy without, you know, reaching for their drug or their alcohol.
When you talk about chronic diseases and narcotics addiction or drug addiction, it sets some people off because they say this is a matter of free will and that should be factored in. Some people can stop and not relapse, and some people simply do relapse. And so I'm wondering why this is a disease in your mind. I mean, obviously it needs treatment, it needs compassion, but I ask that question in part because nicotine is supposed to be more addictive than heroin, and we don't call nicotine addiction a disease.
Well, you know, I think of nicotine dependence is a disease, actually, Michael. I mean, but I think the things people get mixed up on is to say addiction is a disease is not to say that a lot of drug and alcohol use is necessarily a disease. There are people who use lots of drugs and alcohol and do not get addicted. There are people who quit all the time without treatment. After every college graduation, there are a lot of people who change their drinking behavior dramatically without treatment. So I think people are looking at two different things. They say, I know people who drank a lot or used drugs and stopped. Therefore, there's no such thing as addiction. But addiction is a change in the body.
Change in the brain,
yeah,
literally.
Change in the brain, yeah. And for reasons we don't fully understand, we adapt to these various chemicals to varying degrees based on, you know, our genes and our biology, such that sometimes when we use them for extended periods, we develop a new drive that becomes as important to us or more important as eating and, you know, caring for our young and all the things we normally use to keep ourselves alive. So that it, you know, what I care about all day is not you know, meeting my responsibilities or even, you know, or bathing or feeding my kids or job. It's I got to score. And that's not something people were born with. It's a result of an exposure to a drug for a long time combined with biology.
We have new drugs. We have, in fact, a whole cornucopia of pharmacology now that can actually help addiction. It can prevent relapses. That can also prevent overdoses. They're not necessarily being used to the extent they should be, though.
Yeah, you're right. We do have good treatments for particularly opiate addiction, by the way. I mean, we have Suboxone, methadone maintenance, which is the older drug most people would know. We also have life-saving drugs for the acute overdose situation, like naloxone.
Which is also called Narcan. Right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But as an enterprise, addiction treatment in the United States suffers from two problems that tend to go together in our country, which is not having enough money and being stigmatized. And those have fed each other. The insurance until very recently didn't cover addiction in most people's plans. That means there's less resources to hire good staff. There's less resources to build more facilities, to make it accessible, to make them high quality. And that feeds itself. Then the enterprise isn't that good. The people in it aren't respected. And also, a lot of times when clients use the services, they're dissatisfied. I mean, they look at this correctly and say, this looks like an impoverished system where I don't get a lot of choices. And that feeds itself. And then people don't want to go to treatment.
Shouldn't we also mention, though, that some of these new drugs can also lead to abuse or addiction?
That is correct. I mean, if the substitute treatments for opioids, meaning, when you take an opioid, you're having a particular effect in your brain with heroin, for example. But we can put other medications in there that are far less dangerous, like buprenorphine, like methadone. But those are still opiates. So, yes, people can overdose on those medications. But the rate, I have to say, is dramatically lower for people in methadone maintenance or people in buprenorphine maintenance compared to people shooting on the street with heroin, where the death rate can be as high as, 2-3% of the population.
So they can save lives.
They do save lives.
And they do save lives. And we're looking at an Affordable Care Act that can save lives too now.
That's right, yeah. I mean, the good news is that just in the last 2 months, the final provisions of the Affordable Care Act, combined with something called the Parity Law, which passed in 2008 and the regulations just came out, and then new changes in Medicare, which just took effect January 1st, several hundred million Americans, they may not know it, just got better coverage for addiction treatment in their insurance. So that's a revolution and a great achievement for a lot of people in this country politically and at the grassroots.
What kind of treatment?
Outpatient, inpatient. I mean, the Affordable Care Act defines substance abuse for the first time as an essential health care benefit. So all new plans must offer benefits, and they must offer them at parity. The parity law requires employers to cover addiction treatment. And Medicare, which had historically, for outpatient services, covered addiction and mental health at a much lower rate as of January 1st, now covers them at the same rate as all other medical care.
Keith Humphreys again with us in studio, professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences with the Stanford School of Medicine. Vitka Eisen is the CEO of HealthRight 360, which is a Bay Area-based group of health programs that includes Walden House and Haight-Ashbury Free Clinics. And I must say, your personal story really struck me. I mean, from being a heroin addict to going to Harvard and now being a CEO. I mean, I would have spent at least an hour with you talking about your story, but you've been dealing with so much drug addiction now as head of Walden House. And let's talk about just these high recidivism rates. I mean, they're really depressing because the number of people who are addicted continues to seemingly go up. And the relapses and the recidivism is also something that even people who go through the most expensive rehab treatments go back and back and back.
Sure. It's a complex health condition, and I really appreciate you having us on the show to be able to talk about it. Substance use disorder is a very complex health condition, and it's a little bit different in different people, so there's not a one-size-fits-all in terms of treatment. People come to substance use disorder through different paths, and so the kinds of treatments and the interventions that we typically use, however, are really, think of it as an acute intervention. In other words, we treat people in an intensive short-term way when really it's a chronic condition. And the system, kind of the payment system and the care system, isn't really designed for long-term recovery management, which is what's required to have a positive effect.
There are no short-term solutions, really.
There are no short-term solutions. And even some of the medications that you were discussing earlier, although they're life-saving, none of them are perfect. And they're not perfect for all substances, right? So buprenorphine works great for opiate-dependent persons, but it has no impact on methamphetamine users. We haven't found perfect solutions for those yet. And again, there's a biological component to substance use disorder. There's a behavioral component. There's a social component. We really have to address all of those if we want to have kind of a comprehensive long-term impact on substance use disorder.
No, as you say, resonates, especially in light of the fact that only about 1 out of 10 people actually get treatment,
sure,
you know, who are addicted. And there was a Columbia University report, I'm sure you're familiar with, that says the vast majority of addicts get no evidence-based care at all.
It's true. So the Affordable Care Act will allow lots of people who didn't have access to care to get care, particularly in states that take advantage of the Medicaid expansion. It is a covered benefit under the 10 essential health benefits under the Affordable Care Act, and it is intended to apply to those on the Medicaid expansion. So in California, for example, the drug Medi-Cal benefit, which is the substance use disorder treatment benefit for low-income folks, is going to be expanded to many more people, but it's a very limited benefit. And again, it's really designed for an acute care system, and the benefit design isn't really designed for a long-term intervention. It's not really based on the latest in science and research on treatment. It's group focused. It won't cover most residential inpatient substance use disorder treatment because there's a limit on the size of the facility you can treat people in. So there's real limits to it. There's great opportunities, but there's also still lots of work to be done.
Well, Ann Fletcher, who wrote a book called Inside Rahab, for example, I'm sure you're familiar with, says a lot of the treatments that are going on are the same that were used back in the 1950s, but what you do is kind of a full treatment. I'd like you to talk about that a bit. I mean, you're looking at employment, at housing, at just the whole picture, and also mental, physical, and spiritual.
True. The clients that we deal with have complex health conditions. As I said, they're low income. Many folks have been inside state prisons. They have co-occurring mental illness. They often come to us with having never really held a job that they can sustain themselves on. They have very unstable housing conditions, and we have a very short period of time to treat them in. Back when I was in treatment, which is like 30 years ago, the treatment episode was 2 years, 3 years, and it was a far healthier population. You stayed in treatment until you had a job and you had housing and you had a broad social
This is publicly
supports.
Funded.
Publicly funded.
Which sometimes do better jobs than these fancy, expensive rehab places that Britney Spears and Lindsay
this
Lohan
This is true. There's
go
more
to,
accountability yeah. for public programs. So today the treatment interventions, they are 6 months. Clients are much 6 months because that's what the funding typically is, sometimes 90 days. The clients have far more challenges, many more health conditions. And so at HealthRight 360, we really have to focus on all of the things that people need in order to get well. We need to help build in positive social supports. We need to address chronic health conditions that have been unaddressed. Our clients have diabetes too, and they have hypertension, and they are tobacco dependent in addition to having substance use disorders. They have untreated mental illness. They are bipolar. And so if we have to treat all of those kind of simultaneously, including the tobacco dependence, if we want to see some kind of long-term success, and we have to start immediately.
Again, Vitka Eisen here with us in studio, CEO of HealthRight 360. And David Sheff is also with us this morning, a journalist and author. His book, Clean, Overcoming Addiction and Ending America's Greatest Tragedy. And his earlier book, which we discussed on Forum, which is quite a narrative about his son, Nick, called Beautiful Boy, A Father's Journey Through His Son's Addiction. David, I mean, you've written so much about the subject and done really yeoman work in terms of your journalism and editorials, and boils down to the fact that we've got kids out there who are dying. I mean, and not only ODing, but the fact of the matter is, I mean, you even mentioned tough love as part of the problem.
Yeah, it's a tragedy that, you know, unfortunately, I mean, it was a nightmare, heartbreaking to hear about Philip Seymour Hoffman. I think we all just admired him so much, but it's unfortunate that it takes the death of someone prominent like that for us to be talking about what I consider to be the biggest problem we have in America, the biggest health problem, this crisis, because of how much it costs us in lives and in healthcare costs and in criminal justice costs. Every day I get letters from mostly from parents telling me about their kids who are suffering now or else who've passed away. Almost all the time now, the kids who are dying are starting with prescription medications.
That's the gateway drug, really, isn't it?
Right now, I mean, I just heard from a mom just this morning. There was an email from this mom whose kid had got in a skiing accident, went to the hospital, came home with OxyContin, used the drug until the bottle was empty, and then kept buying OxyContin. It was very expensive. So ultimately switched to a cheaper opiate, which was heroin, and he died.
And the heroin epidemic, I mean, it's unfortunate, as you say, that it has to come into our spotlight because of the death of a great actor like Philip Seymour Hoffman. But it's getting worse.
Yeah, it's getting worse. And I think most of it is driven by what I understand is it's driven by the prescription pill problem. And there are problems related to the heroin. You know, heroin has got
Vicodin too. I mean, just
Vicodin, OxyContin. I mean, I think all the opiates. And the heroin is. I mean, heroin has gotten is. I think the difference is sometimes it costs $50 for a kid to get a pill, an OxyContin pill from a friend at school or whatever it is, and the same you get a hit of heroin now for $10.
Now, I know you've also dealt with policy questions, and some of your concern is ending mandatory sentences for kids. Eric Holder's already put a directive out on that, but also if a kid calls 911, a kid can get in trouble. I mean, and we're talking about saving lives here.
Yeah, it's insane. I mean, right now, I think there are 14 states that have something called the 911 Good Samaritan Law, which protects someone who calls 911. But often, kids are together at a party, they're using, somebody passes out, and then when the others finally figure out that there's a problem, they panic. And they don't call the police, they don't call 911 because they're afraid that they're going to get in trouble, and they probably will. This law, the 911 laws are just so important because what they do is they protect someone from being prosecuted, and of course no one should be arrested or prosecuted for saving another's life.
But what about ending mandatory sentences for minors who use drugs? I mean, there are a lot of people, not necessarily hardliners, who say, use drugs, you should go to jail.
Well, it's ludicrous in my opinion. We know that drug use is rooted in many, many factors, but a lot of it is stress. A lot of it is environment. So you take someone who's using drugs, potentially addicted or on the road to becoming addicted, and throw them into the criminal justice system and talk about increasing stress in their lives, taking them out of school or making them less employable because they're going to have a criminal record. I mean, what we want to do, in fact, I think it's just really clear, is that we want to get people who are having drug problems into the best treatment we can right away.
Well, President Obama's promised to focus on addiction as a health problem. Is he coming through? I mean, putting Affordable Care Act obviously is a centerpiece of it, but beyond that.
Well, Affordable Care Act is huge. The problem still is, the administration is doing some great things. They're making Narcan a priority. They want to have that available to reverse opiate addictions, opiate overdoses. They want to have first responders to have that.
Police officers using Narcan.
There are. The problem, though, is that we still are focused, we're focused more on treatment, but still way, way more on the criminal justice law enforcement. I think the current budget is about $24 billion for the federal budget, and about three quarters of that is still focused on the same kinds of policies that, hasn't lowered the drug use, it hasn't lowered the drug death number. When we talk about the war on drugs, we talk about a system that actually has failed us and it really needs to be changed. And the good piece is that I do think that there are people in the Obama administration who understand this. It just is going to take a while for the changes that are going to actually make a difference to come through.
Well, one of the changes that you've suggested, I think a number of articles you've written, is a new drug czar should come from public health addiction medicine rather than to be a top cop kind of figure.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, even police officers I talk to, they arrest these kids or young adults and they bring them to, they bring them to jail and then they see them again in 3 or 4 days or else they see them again if they get out in a month or if they're sentenced, to 6 months or a year in jail, they see them again and again and again. They wouldn't see them again and again and again if we got them into treatment. And it's just, it's so obvious, but of course. And the other thing is, when people resist this idea, all we have to do is look at the last, 40 years of failure, the trillions of dollars we've spent on the problem trying to stop the supply. And yet, they describe it as a game of whack-a-mole. We can maybe make a dent in one drug problem when you know the use of one drug and then another one pops up, because people who are addicted, people who want drugs, are going to find them. So we have to help people so that they no longer become addicted.
Again, David Sheff is the author of Clean, Overcoming Addiction and Ending America's Greatest Tragedy. Let me go back to you, Keith Humphries, because you were advising at the White House. I mean, from your experience there and from all we've been saying, what should be first steps here for us, not only in terms of addiction and treatment, but prevention?
Yeah, I mean, every person should have access to addiction treatment. And that, you know, that was one of the central goals of the Affordable Care Act and the parity laws. And that is truly transformative, I mean, those changes. And so I think that's critical. And I understand entirely from working with addicts in my career why people want to put them in prison. Addicts are difficult. They hurt our feelings. They steal things. And out of frustration and anger, because let's lock them up. Let's lock them away. I understand that emotion. But that is crazy. It's horrible for them. And it's in the end, it makes it more destructive. So what do you do about that? Well, I think you have to use the criminal justice system when people commit a crime and have a drug or alcohol problem in a different way. You don't put people in prison, but you do put them in some type of monitoring, whether it's, you know, a drug court that monitors their treatment. There are also different models now. HOPE probation is a well-known one. 24/7 sobriety is another one, where people are regularly tested and they're monitored. They also get services. Those kinds of things can rehabilitate people, keep them in the community, and not put them in prison. Because once you go into prison, everything changes for you, and usually for the worse, for the long term. So I'm pleased about the fact that
Drugs are pretty accessible in prison for the most part too, have money.
Yeah, well, some. Yeah, it's less compared to the community, certainly. But I mean, you know, the prison population in the United States went up for 35 straight years. Which is not something to be proud of. It has gone down every year under President Obama. That, to me, is pretty remarkable.
Anything you want to add here, Witgeisen? We were talking about treatment and prevention and necessary changes, vital changes.
I had the opportunity to work in substance use disorder treatment inside the state prisons, and it was astounding to me that for many of the clients I worked with, it was their first exposure to treatment. So why would a person have to go to prison
to get treatment?
To get care. Yeah. And there's just something wrong with the system that does that.
And you were bored here, David Sheffield.
Well, I was just going to say, Michael, that the goal is to prevent people from getting to the point where they are breaking into jewelry stores and robbing or breaking. You know, my son, when he got was addicted when he was on the streets, he broke into our own house and our friends' homes. We want to prevent that from happening. And the way that we prevent it from happening is we recognize that this is a disease that is usually progressive. And if we can catch it earlier, we can stop it from progressing. And so we can take away that need to have the conversation even about the criminal justice system. There are so many things we can do to prevent our kids from using, but we're not doing it.
Well, I'm going to throw it out to you, our listeners. We certainly would like to hear from you on this subject, and it is indeed a grave and exceedingly important subject, and there may be some stories that you have to tell, questions, comments. You are now certainly invited cordially to join the program. Our toll-free number is available to you. Please feel free to use it. It's 866-733-6786. Again, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, join us as we're talking about addiction, prevention, treatment. 866-733-6786. A number of other ways of joining the program. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or join us by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. But please feel free to join the program. Tragic news of actor Philip Seymour Hoffman's death by apparent heroin overdose after more than two decades of sobriety has called attention once again to the immense challenges faced by those dealing with addiction. We're talking about it. Relapse, most effective methods of treatment, rehabilitation, prevention, and we'll hear from you when we return. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the effects of drug addiction and what to do about it. The numbers, unfortunately, for overdoses have been rising steadily over the past two decades, and heroin is a global epidemic. It's what killed actor Philip Seymour Hoffman, an overdose of it, and there are over 38,000 overdoses each year. Talking with David Sheff here in studio, journalist and author of Clean, Overcoming Addiction and Ending America's Greatest Tragedy, also the author of Beautiful Boy, A Father's Journey Through His Son's Addiction, and Witgeisen, who is now CEO of HealthRight 360, a barrier-based group of health programs, which includes Walden House and the Haight-Ashbury Free Clinics, and Keith Humphreys, professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford and also research scientist at the VA Medical Center in Palo Alto and former senior policy advisor at the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy. We're going to go right forthwith to your calls and emails. I just want to ask any of the members of the panel here who are with us in studio, if you can speak about the effects of Proposition 36 passed back in the year 2000, which was going to put drug offenders in rehab instead of locking them up, because we've been talking about that. And has it had much of an impact? And what's the status of it?
Well, as is often true, I find with public policy, once they're able to they do a good evaluation, kind of a rigorous evaluation of it, and they find that it's effective and it saves $4 in taxpayer dollars for every dollar spent on treatment, then they cut the funding. So although Prop 36 exists on the books, there's all the funding for the services that was a big network of care that was brought up statewide. All the funding was eliminated.
We'll go to your calls. And let's begin with Doug. Doug, you're on.
Good morning. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
I'm very the dead Seymour Hoffman because, like him, I'm in my early 40s.
I think we're having a problem with your line, and I'm sorry you have to call us back. A young man who, got hooked about, he was 23 years off heroin. He wanted to tell us, and he doesn't feel safe. You know, he doesn't feel safe in terms of falling back into addiction, and I'm afraid there are many in that boat. But let me go to some more calls here. Kyle is joining us from Milpitas. Hi, Kyle.
Hey, how's it going?
Thank you.
Yeah, I just wanted to call and say that me and my wife are both heroin addicts. We smoke heroin every day. We used it to overcome a meth addiction. Now, $100 a day mandatory we have to spend. It's ridiculous. We both work. My wife works at a law firm. I'm a painter. And I just wanted to call and say that if we had access to, like, a doctor we could go to and he could give us, a combination of prescription drugs like benzodiazepines, some clonidine, just like a bunch of different things like to help us kick, we would definitely be interested in kicking. But right now, my wife can't kick because she'll lose her job. When you kick, you can't really sleep for 7 days. And it's just like Suboxone, that doesn't work because you have to start the withdrawal process. And that's like our biggest fear, you know?
Again, we get, to funds and revenue, and Keith Humphreys, want to address his concern here?
What I would suggest doing is looking at the website of the California Society on Addiction Medicine, and find a certified provider, a certified physician, and that's where I would go, and I would do it quickly because what you're doing, as I gather you know, is very dangerous.
And good luck to you, Kyle. Thank you for the call. I appreciate hearing from you. Let me go to some more callers here. And this is Lisa from Richmond. Lisa, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi. I'm surprised that considering the role that prescription drugs play in creating addictions, that nobody's talked about issues with overprescription in the medical industry. My stepson, when he was 14, he had ankle surgery and was prescribed Vicodin in the same dose that my husband, who weighed about 100 pounds more, was prescribed for when he had hand surgery. So it was, take two every 4 hours for however long. And there's really no, when doctors give you those things, there's not really a lot of guidance in terms of whether or not there's other less potent drugs that your children might take. We actually didn't end up allowing him to take any of it. We gave them some Tylenol. I think I had some Tylenol with codeine around the house, and we gave him a couple of those and let him suffer a little bit. But it's really dangerous, and I don't think that the medical industry is very conscientious about it. I know when I was in high school, my friends used to go to the emergency room, and they would claim they had a horrible headache and just get in order to get narcotics. So I think that's something really important to talk about in terms of the role that
I'm glad you've raised that, Lisa. And David Sheff, you've done a lot of research on this. Overprescription's pretty common.
Well, I can tell you that my daughter, it was 6 months ago, had to have her wisdom teeth taken out. And when she was finished, she left the dentist's office with a prescription for, I believe it was 20 Vicodin, refillable twice. So we could have gotten, if we wanted, 60 Vicodin for wisdom teeth taken out in a 17-year-old. You know, she took a half of one and then decided, you know, she was fine. So we could have had all those pills, and that's what happens is, you know, parents, the number one way that kids get those prescription medications is in their parents' medicine cabinets. Why do doctors, you know, prescribe, over-prescribe? I mean, I've heard a lot of different things. Part of it is just history. They don't want to deal with patients who call up after the first prescription runs out. But I think that, you know, absolutely things have to change. We have to educate doctors. I think there are, you know, there's doctor shopping. Now there's going to be databases so that, you know, we'll know if somebody's going to three or four different doctors in order to get pills.
Let me read actually on point here an email from a listener named Rocky who says, in the last year I have had three friends die from overdose. They were all users of OxyContin. Seems to me that pharmaceuticals are far more dangerous in many cases than illegal drugs. I'm, for example, addicted to alcohol. However, I was able to quit crack cocaine on my own. I mean, prescription drugs, and how much of that do you see, Ms. Eisen, in terms of the work you do, Vitguys, and pharmaceutical drug addictions as opposed to illegal drugs?
So one of the complex conditions that we find in our work today is, so most of our clients who come to us, by the time they come to us, it's a street drug addiction. However, many of them also have a co-occurring chronic pain condition. So they come to us and they have, you know, they're older folks and they have herniated discs and they have blown knees. And so they're struggling with a substance use disorder. And at the same time, they have prescriptions for OxyContin and Percocet and muscle relaxers. And so I think it's an almost impossible situation to try to manage those drugs for your pain condition and your substance use disorder at the same time. And I think the field is compelled to find an alternate solution. So what we see rather than this, we see people who have heroin addiction, but they also have prescriptions for Percocet for pain. And we really must come up with some kind of an alternative to that.
Let me go to another question for you, if I may. Regina asks, excuse me, don't addicts have to seek out treatment and agree to go to rehab? How many addicts do this in the grand scheme of the drug world? And why is the DEA not more forceful in closing down drug trafficking? Well, that's a huge bag of worms in itself. But, you know, talk about the voluntary drug treatment, if you would.
So I think, you know, people's motivation for treatment is it's ambivalent. Most people approach treatment in a state of complete ambivalence, and their motivation changes moment by moment. You know, substance use it hijacks the brain's reward system. So to move against that, you reward it. Drug use is highly rewarding, and treatment doesn't feel as rewarding immediately. And so I think the notion of what's voluntary and what's not voluntary, it's kind of complicated because people don't walk in there thinking, hey, this is going to be really fun. And I think the key to that is a combination of high incentives. We have to incent, you know, people. If your reward system has been hijacked by a powerful drug, then we need to come up with incentives that kind of give you that help drive against that, that compel you in other ways, and some coercion. Some coercion has been shown to be effective.
What do you mean by coercion, though?
By coercion, I mean you can go to treatment or you can go to jail. So some coercion is effective, but I think a system that is solely based on coercion is not effective. So it's a combination of coercion and incentive that helps people overcome that ambivalence, which is really the hallmark of addiction.
Again, Vitguys, and again, is CEO of HealthRight 360. Jim from Santa Clara writes, can we please stop using phrases drugs and alcohol and drugs or alcohol? A simple change to drugs, including alcohol, should make a difference in how we think about one of the most frequently abused drugs. Let me go to another caller. Ruse, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I'm an Iraq war vet, and I got out in 2008, and I had some pretty bad PTSD, and I tried to go to all different avenues to address it. The only thing I could find was the pot. But now it's getting to the point where I can't get myself off the pot. If I try to, then the PTSD, I'm just kind of in a bind. I don't know.
Yeah, PTSD and pot, Keith Humphreys, I mean, if it can provide some relief, he's saying, what do I do? I can't get off it.
Yeah, you know, I thank you for your service, and I'm very sympathetic to the situation. I obviously can't, not knowing you, give you personal advice beyond getting connected to a good care provider, whether that's through the VA, which has, you know, quite a network of PTSD and addiction treatment, or through other means. There are a lot of – with a lot of emotional and psychiatric problems, drugs are great in the short term but destructive in the long term. So getting connected to someone who can monitor over time, support, and look at you as a total person, I think is what is the best thing to do.
And, Ruz, if I could make a recommendation, I've been involved every year in emceeing the Dinner of Swords to Plowshares, which is an organization that helps veterans, and I would strongly recommend maybe giving them a call as well. Good luck to you, and I appreciate your call. Brings up another question, though, I've got to ask you, Keith Humphries. I mean, there's new data that's suggesting that, contrary to what many of us thought, particularly in the 60s, marijuana may indeed be a gateway drug.
Well, marijuana in the 60s was different than marijuana now. I mean, like a lot of agriculturally based drugs, it's gotten more potent. The THC, which is the main chemical in it, is at much higher concentrations now. So generational experience from one time could be different than what's going on now. We do know, there is a big increase in the number of people smoking marijuana every single day, and higher intensity marijuana, and that is really worrisome. Yeah, it can be a gateway drug. Although I agree, by the way, with the person who wrote in about alcohol. Alcohol.
It's a drug.
Yeah, alcohol is a drug, and it's more destructive in terms of crime, violence, putting people to prison than a lot of the illegal drugs we worry about so much.
Actually, talk about those illegal drugs. Marie writes in an email, what about someone who likes being a drug addict, who doesn't want to be clean and sober, or likes a lifestyle? It sounds totally wrong, but I think there are people who do not want a life without their addiction, maybe addicted to addiction.
No, it's absolutely true. I mean, you can see that by the number of people who don't come in voluntarily. I mean, most people come in under some pressure. Legal pressure, as Vitka mentioned, but we used to talk about the four L's, liver, lover, livelihood, and the law. There's usually pressure from one of those L's when someone comes to treatment. Rarely do people wake up and say, I'm really not self-actualizing. I'm going to go to 500 AA meetings and rehab. That usually doesn't happen.
We'll go to more of our callers, and we'll welcome Courtney from San Jose. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a father and two older brothers who all went to prison under age 25, all drug-related crime, robberies, etc. And my older brother actually OD'd from his addiction 3 years ago, a combination of prescribed drugs and the other legal drug, alcohol, which we're describing today. What I'm curious about from the panel is, what are state or county programs that have actually successfully decriminalized addicts so that they can get the treatment they need, but also are successful at changing the public's fixed mindset about drug addicts, which we're hearing, today in some of the emails. I think there's still a fixed mindset out there that drug addicts, are bad actors, that it's not a disease. I mean, there's still a lot of the 1935, stigma that was around when AA came out that I experienced.
Well, Courtney, thank you for your call, and I'm sorry for your loss of your brother, Vitka Eisen.
So there are a number of programs that have been proven effective at working specifically with the criminal justice population. The state of California had invested very heavily in providing substance use disorder treatment for people in prison, and found that it reduced the recidivism rate remarkably. If people were offered treatment while they were in prison and that was followed by a community-based course of treatment and aftercare, it reduced the recidivism rate by 20%, which is a really pretty remarkable number. And that meant that people not only didn't return to drug use, they also didn't return to crime, since about 80% of the people who are incarcerated have some kind of history of it's estimated about 80% have some kind of history of drug involvement. So if you treat the substance use disorder, you're really going to help reduce the crime as well.
Yeah, but I'm looking at a tweet here from a listener who says, if we take away the threat of jail, how do we create deterrence? I mean, in many people's minds, the two are wedded together. David,
well, I would say that there are many other deterrents. And I would also suggest, this is something that Courtney had mentioned about the word, the stigma that comes around this. Part of the reason that there is a stigma is because we've made this into a moral question, a question of right and wrong, a criminal question, instead of treating it as a health problem, which is what it is. And when it's because we are judging addicts, we are judging drug users, even kids. I mean, there's a physician, a pediatrician who says, because we have this idea that good kids don't use drugs, bad kids use, we're instantly stigmatizing them and use, and therefore it goes underground. They don't talk about it. But, as he said, these aren't bad kids. These are our kids. The I think as people get educated to the fact that this is a disease, it's a brain disease, the stigma somewhat goes away when we start to treat people earlier so that there is not their disease doesn't progress to the point where they are committing crimes and lying and stealing and doing these things. The stigma will go away. It, I would say, may be the biggest factor. The stigma, the way we think about drug users as opposed to people with other other illnesses, may be the biggest factor in the high uses of drug rates and the high number of people that we're losing.
I just want to add to that, Michael,
sorry,
if I could. It's also been important groups like Faces and Voices of Recovery that have been, you know, giving a public face, as Vitka does, to what recovery is like. Addiction in its active phase is extremely visible, and recovery is often hidden. So someone walks by you in a suit. They used to have a drug problem. They don't. You don't notice them, but you notice the person lying in the street. And so the fact that more people have been coming out and saying, look, I had a drug problem. I'm in recovery. I think that helps a lot. It makes people see that, you know, this isn't a one-way route necessarily to death and destruction. You can still have a really good life. There's a reason to have hope. I think that's been a good contribution recovering people have made.
And Kevin, our next caller, good morning.
Hello, from Emeryville. I'm wondering what the panelists think about the prevalence of 12-step, especially among the staff that an addict will encounter and will be cared for by initially when they come in, and some of the disapproval and judgment, and kind of going back to the moral question that you can get from people who are really into 12-step who are also staff.
I'm glad you brought up 12-step programs, Kevin. I mean, not only in terms of the stigma that might be associated with them that you mentioned, but also just the whole question of their efficacy. And, Guyzen, what do you find?
12-step programs are actually a remarkable institution in this globally, actually. It's all over the world. And they're remarkable in their reach and their effectiveness. They provide long-term support for people in recovery. They provide for many people a spiritual basis for their recovery. And they're an important, I think of the whole toolkit in terms of treating substance use disorder. And I think that 12-step programs are a very, very critical piece of that.
So what are their recidivism rate of those who've been through 12-step programs, though? Do we know, Keith Humphrey?
Yeah, we've done randomized trials, which is the most rigorous kind of study we do in medicine of AA and its sister programs, and find it does as well as or better than professional addiction treatment on average with a variety of populations. So it absolutely is a valuable resource. But I would say to people who then take from that, maybe in their enthusiasm or their gratitude, that every single person must do this, is even the people who founded those programs said this wasn't for everybody. And so it's not that there's anything wrong with 12-step, but there is something wrong with the idea that every single person must fit in here. And that gets to be really tough for people, for example, who need Suboxone or need methadone maintenance and feel deeply disapproved of when they go into those rooms.
It's also tough for atheists and agnostics who didn't necessarily want to concede to a higher power, although they form their own chapters,
yeah,
I think.
People don't like groups, too. I mean, you know, they have great anxiety about, you know, so you know, in any other field, one thing that worked wouldn't be good enough, you know. But again, because of the low status, low money work, well, we got one thing that works, so we're going to give it to everybody. You know, if you did that in any other business, you'd go broke, right?
But could you say something also about what Kevin raised, that is the stigma of being in a 12-step program? You're going to a job and people know you're in a 12-step program?
You know, I think it's not – I don't know. I'm not in one, so, you know, I'm looking at it on the outside. I mean, I think in general, people who are in recovery – overestimate how much they're going to be disapproved of for being in recovery. Maybe because they underestimate how many people knew they were addicted all along. And I've had people tell me in terror, you know, just so you know, I've been sober these last 8 months. And it's like, yeah, well, I noticed you were drunk the last 8 years, so this is actually good news, not bad news. I'm glad you told me, but if you were the only one who was really worried that we would be upset that you're in recovery.
So let me thank Kevin for his call. David Sheff.
Well, I just wanted to say something else about the 12 steps, which, again, you know, it's a profound system that has helped and saved many, many lives. The reason that I am concerned about the emphasis on 12 steps is that it does turn off a lot of people, and especially, I think, teenagers, adolescents who need treatment. You know, they need treatment before their problem escalates. And what I hear all the time from moms and dads who've lost their kids many times, my child went through, you know, 5-7 treatment programs, hated the 12 steps, refused to go back. And in some ways, maybe it's anathema in some ways to being a teenager. I mean, you have to turn your life over to a higher power. You have to admit you're powerless. And, I mean, teenagers aren't going to turn their lives over to anyone. And so I guess, you know, it goes to Dr. Humphrey's point that we need to have alternatives. Certainly the 12 steps has to be part of the arsenal, but behavioral treatments, pharmacology, whatever helps an individual is what we need to do.
Why are you critical of tough love? I mean, you've mentioned it along with gangs as a killer, essentially, of kids.
Well, we've got these kids who are sick, and they need to be in treatment. We have this idea that, it's an old, age-old idea that really is archaic, which suggests that, we have to shut the door. They have to come crawling back. They have to, want it so badly. First of all, I think we know that whatever lands a person in treatment is equally effective. And the other thing is tough love is really dangerous. You close the door on someone that you love until they, beg to go into treatment, and they could die any minute, and they do.
You're talking, you're listening to Forum, and we're talking with David Sheff as well as Keith Humphries and Witka Eisen. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, simply go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we'll go to more of your calls. We'll go to Oakland next. Debbie, thanks for waiting. Join us. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My question and comment, I guess, is about the use of Suboxone. And I understand that it's used. I'm in long-term recovery. I have almost 30 years. And
congratulations.
Thank you. It's an amazing life. And I just want to say quickly that the East Bay young people are rocking. So any young people, if you've got an adolescent, head them over to the East Bay. But anyway, my question about Suboxone is I understand that it is used, to detox people. I understand some people may choose to maintain Suboxone long term. But I do have experience with people, in recovery who have detoxed from Suboxone. One young man I know through Kaiser went in and wanted to detox from Suboxone, and his health person encouraged him to stay on it. And I'm a little concerned that sometimes within society it's easier to say, we'll just keep these guys on a drug dependence because then we know they're not ripping off our cars, versus helping somebody who may at some point want to detox. I know that occasionally people detox from Suboxone and then go out and use again. Don't get me wrong, but I feel like my concern is that the institution now is beginning to use Suboxone as a drug dependence program, which for some people may work, but to encourage that really is problematic to me. So I'd love to hear what your guests have.
Can I get a comment from you on this, Dr. Humphries?
That is one of the biggest issues about these medications, and that was a marvelously articulate comment. There has to be something, I think, that the individual person works out with their individual health care provider. There are people who do need to be on these medications probably forever. There is some risk of relapse going off them. At the same time, I totally agree that people want more to be than to be managed. They want to have a life, and sometimes that means for them developing other things or getting other types of services, a job, other types of counseling, and also not taking the medication and finding other ways to maintain their recovery. I would just say, though, make those decisions slowly, not quickly. As we've been saying, this is not an acute problem. So someone may say, look, I've been on it for a month. I feel great. I'm ready to go off it. That's probably a bad decision. This is the kind of decision you want to make over longer stretches. Look at how did this last year go? What can I do? What do my family and friends think? What does my doctor think? Make them slowly and carefully.
And thank you, Debbie, for that phone call. And we'll get another caller on right away. Sarvi, good morning.
Hi. My question is with respect to treatment of addictions. We always seem to be focusing on drugs, and I wonder if it's probably because of the finances behind the drug industry. I've read lots of good articles that talk about Vipassana meditation, a certain specific kind of meditation that's supposed to kind of develop the emotions, and I've read articles that show that it helps addiction quite a bit. On a related note, I've also read that LSD at some point in the past was experimented for a treatment of addictions, but right now it It's an illegal drug, and it's a non-addicting thing that's supposed to be able to get people addiction. I'd like to hear some.
Well, Sarvi, I thank you for the call. There is we've done programs showing there's evidence, Keith Humphreys, about meditation helping.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, there's a wonderful studies done in prison. If you learn alternative ways to manage stress, you get a better emotional state. That's going to lower your risk for relapse. On the LSD question, yeah, there was a great enthusiasm. There's always been great enthusiasm, going back to at least when Freud said you could, you know, take cocaine to stop taking morphine, to take another drug to get off the current one. And LSD for alcoholism was kind of endured a little boomlet in the 60s, and then it had a huge trial showing that it didn't work. So that's actually why we don't use LSD for alcoholism. It's just because it doesn't work.
Let me ask you, we've got seconds left here, but each of you – hopeful about what we can do to ameliorate this ongoing scourge of drug addiction and the problems that we have with drug addiction, David?
I'm hopeful. It's going to take a while, but people are just getting tired of these numbers of all that this is costing us in lives and in money. Addicts themselves are getting tired of sort of hiding in the shadows, and they're coming out and they're organizing. They're pushing for some of these laws that actually are going to help. It's this great hidden problem, and that is changing. The Affordable Care Act is going to make a big difference. I mean, there are reasons to be hopeful.
And Keith, you mentioned the importance of the Affordable Care Act.
Absolutely. There's been more growth in the health insurance for addiction in the last few years than in the last 50. So, yes, I am optimistic too.
Vic Geisen?
And I think that technologies around treatment have become so much more sophisticated than and really grown by leaps and bounds in the last 10 years that I think that we're doing better every day and that we will continue to do better.
On that note, thank you all. Thanks for the work that you do. And thanks to you, our listeners. Another hour ahead. Linda Ronstadt joins us. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.